everybody. Welcome to RFRX. Rob, how are you doing this evening?
How could I not be doing good? It's RFRX night.
Great answer. Best night of the week. Well, welcome. Y'all may have noticed that we are not Eric. Eric is here, but he has been giving another talk to a different group this evening. He is very busy. So we are filling in today for him. It's going to be me and Rob hosting this evening with our fantastic guest. Actually, Rob is going to introduce our guest because I can read our outline. So go for it, Rob.
Okay, so Rachel Roberts is the co-author of Confessions of an American Nun, a credo of sorts. The study of religion has been her passion since young adulthood. She has a bachelor's degree with an emphasis on philosophy of religion and a master's degree in theological studies from Southern Methodist University. She grew up in a Christian cult with her mother, yet her father was an atheist. We're going to have to find out about that. After an on-again, off-again relationship with Christianity as an adult, Rachel found her truth and freedom in coming out as a non-believer. Rachel has three children, a dog named Tito, a cat named Strudel. Oh, her guilty pleasures include gummy bears, a crisp IPA, and Star Trek. Rachel, take it away.
Let's see if we can get her unmuted. There we go.
Now can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah. That was my bad.
Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I've been looking forward to this ever since the last time. It's such a fun experience, and just super impressed with the community that your organization has built, and super grateful that you guys are doing the work that you're doing. So how do you want to start this party?
Wow, that's a great question. I, for one, am super excited to hear some more conversation with you about Star Trek, but that's not how we're going to start this party. But I'm just putting a pin in that.
Why not? Wait a minute. Which series? Are you following Discovery?
We spent a good deal of time on Star Trek last time. Actually, I was thinking, if it's okay with you guys, I was thinking that for the audience who was not... there for the first interview that I did a few months ago with you guys, that I would just give a very brief synopsis of my book, which kind of chronicles my journey from being raised in a Christian cult to becoming a nun. And then that'll just provide some context for the listeners tonight before we dive into the topic at hand. Is that cool?
Sounds good.
Absolutely. Yeah, please go ahead.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned in my book, I was raised in a fundamentalist loony bin, and it was basically the Amway of religion. It was literally a pyramid scheme where everybody tithed upwards to a few dudes at the top. But that was not the greatest of grievances in that organization. It was a ripe organization for all kinds of abuse. And so in some of the more longer lasting, you know, there was physical abuse, sexual abuse, you know, all kinds of things. Now, not everybody in that organization did all those things, but just the way that it was set up made it more likely, you know what I mean? But the things that were really the most damaging was not so much, you know, the physical abuse, but the things, the beliefs that were ingrained in the way that I was taught to understand reality. And that has taken a lot longer over life to disentangle and shed its imprint in my own psyche. So, but I've done a lot of work in that way. And that's why I ended up getting a master's degree in theology. And for those who are unfamiliar with Southern Methodist University, to some people that might sound scary, but it's sometimes called the Harvard of the South. It has Methodist roots, but is very much a secular university now. Although I did go to the theological school, and they do indeed train ministers just like they still do at Harvard. But it's a super progressive school that understands a right view of hermeneutics, you know, and how to understand the Bible. So anyway, I personally think that, yes, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say, I also went to SMU, so I was just going to back you up on that.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I had some friends. Yay, ponies, which is funny. That looks just like the Horned Frogs, which is where I went to undergrad. So I can still do the same. But yeah, no, it's great. I had friends who were in the religion department there. And yeah, it was, I'll put it this way. I grew up in a kind of similar background as you did. And my family would regard the SMU people as, you know, not real Christians.
Exactly. Yes.
So the mention of hermeneutics has gotten the chat going. I think you need to define that.
Yes. The understanding of the Bible. Hermeneutics is your approach to the Bible and your interpretation of the Bible. So like, and most evangelicals today would say, you know, the Bible, what's written, you take it literally face value, but at an academic school where they're studying the Bible more from the historical perspective and the academic and critical perspective, then you're not preceding your interpretation of the Bible with a superstition.
It's more of an academic study.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, hermeneutics can be either, because that same word would be used by Dallas Theological Seminary. Their hermeneutical approach would be God breathed the Bible, and therefore we interpret this verse very literally, and they won't take into account that, you know, there's been a million different changes and edits and the fallibility of the Bible.
Mm,
yeah.
Got it.
Sorry, I threw in that big word there, but I just, at the end of the day, that's the crux of many problems, is the way modern Americans and people understand the Bible. The fact that the Dallas Theological Seminary people would not even view my education as any kind of credible education.
That's ironic.
That's okay. I'm going to fry in hell anyway, you know, I mean,
right.
from their perspective. So
with your fake degree and everything.
Right. Yeah. But I actually think that having that degree, it did a couple of really useful things for me. It really taught me that there are many people who still are comfortable using the term Christian, and there are freaking amazing humans who are not the standard evangelical bullhorn type Christian that we hear too much of. and that's where I learned the social justice version of Jesus. And I understood it all in a context that I had not been taught before. And so that was super useful for me. And that's why this what I'm wearing right now, it says love is greater than labels. This is my biggest takeaway, is that you can have a person call themselves a Christian and be a complete asshole, or you can have a person call themselves a Christian and they have a completely different worldview, but they happen to label themselves the same way because they understand Jesus differently and they understand the Bible differently. Mm-hmm. And
I don't think I've heard the term before that you just used, the social justice version of Jesus. What does that mean?
Well, so that means that rather than Jesus thinking of himself as the Son of God that came down to earth to, you know, start a new religion where everybody worshiped him, that means that he was exactly who he was, and that was a Middle Eastern man in 2,000 years ago who saw through the bullshit. And y'all might remember about me, I have a potty mouth and I apologize.
That's totally okay. Don't ever apologize.
But he saw through the bullshit of his time, and he saw the way that religion, his own religion at the time, was being used as a tool to oppress others and profit those in power. And he sought to overturn those social dynamics. And that's what he preached. That's what he taught. And that got him killed ultimately, speaking of Martin Luther King Day, similar dynamic. Of course, the complication with Jesus is that the only recorded, you know, history that we have of him or his teachings are not firsthand. And so there's lots of room for interpretation of what was real, what wasn't real, what did he really say, what la la la. And so a social justice version of Jesus is basically somebody with the mindset of a 21st century modern human who understands, what equality should be and understands all these systemic problems that exist in our culture. And can lift out what Jesus was teaching according to the truth that we know today. And the theological school that I went to would even go so far as to say that Jesus, we understand Jesus as being limited by his worldview at the time. So if Jesus was talking about the Father and blah, 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 you know, that's because that was a certain confinement that he knew at the time, but that doesn't mean there wasn't some truth or a lot of truth to what he spoke.
That's interesting. I like the idea of, you know, contextualizing.
Yeah.
You know, well, which, yeah, go ahead.
It's what we do anytime we read any ancient writings, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, we're able to lift out truth where we see it, that because truth rises to the top one way or the other eventually. And so anyway, I digress. did that answer your question?
Yes.
Well, anyway. Okay.
Thank you.
So yes, I graduated with my master's in theological studies only to realize in 2015 when the Pew report came out, changing religious landscape of America. Same month I graduated with my master's degree, and that's when I read in that report that at that time a quarter of our country checked this box called none of the above when asked for their religious affiliation, and that included the option to select atheist, agnostic, new age, whatever. And people are like, don't label me, I don't want to be labeled, I don't fit in these buckets. And that's where I found myself in 2015. And that's why my book, Confessions of an American Nun, N-O-N-E, is what it's called. And it's basically telling my story of moving away from organized religion. And listen, I'm no expert, but I've studied all the major world religions and different philosophies and blah, blah, blah. And ultimately to find that, my dog's going crazy. Hold on.
No worries.
He saw the cat.
We've had some requests for the dog to come back on. So, you know.
Oh, okay. Oh, he'll be back. He prefers to sit in my lap. And I'm a cat person. The dog really loves me.
That's a good sign if a dog loves you.
Well, I guess he just stinks. But anyway, so I guess that's what dogs do. So that's kind of my nutshell story. And what happened was when I realized that I really belong in this nun space, I never felt comfortable saying, I wasn't comfortable saying I was an atheist, mostly because atheist is a bad word in our culture, mm-hmm. and it has a bad PR problem. And so I didn't want to be affiliated with that, but then also I would require somebody to say, if they ask me, did I believe in God? My question back to them immediately is define God. And then I'll tell you if I believe it. And because in studying different mystical traditions of different religions, it all takes you to the same place. It's not this ooey gooey, made up superstition land for people who don't understand the use of the term mysticism. They can think it means, you know, this hippy dippy stuff, but really it's just a deep interior space of awareness, mm-hmm. and that deep interior space of awareness is what connects you to to everything. When you start to see, you know, one of my favorite quotes from Rumi is, you are not a drop in the ocean, you are the ocean in a drop. And it's when you have that deep interior awareness of our interconnection with one another as humans, but also all of reality, which, by the way, is of course backed up by physics. And so that's why I continue to feel very deeply that I'm not the just the my whole or our whole as people is greater than the sum of our parts, not just my mind, not just my emotions or heart or feelings, not just my thoughts, not just my body, but there's something that the whole creates something greater than just those individual pieces. And okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just gonna try and see if I understood. You're kind of saying, you know, just kind of taking a holistic view of, you know, the human experience. And then also it sounds like you're maybe extending that into your experience of spirituality as being something that could encompass pieces of a variety of different traditions or thought processes. Is that accurate?
That's exactly where I was going, is to get to, which I think is really the beginning of the conversation for the topic tonight, is to define the word spiritual or spirituality. Ooh, yeah. I'm going to offer my definition as I've come to understand it, but obviously I'm sure there are many other ways to understand it or define it. For me, I boiled it down to simply being connected to something greater than myself. And when I started doing some writing for American Nun and had some other people who were writing some blog pieces and stuff, that was the baseline definition. Now you can extrapolate on that quite a bit, but the whole idea is that when you have to yield to something greater than just the sum of your parts. So there have been many, many times where my mind or my thinking is the death of me, right? We can get on that hamster wheel internally and it can be our greatest enemy. And so there's a space beyond that, that can put that in check. And that's where I find for me, the spiritual space. And for some people, you know, I've had quite a bit of experience in Al-Anon, which is the companion program to Alcoholics Anonymous for people who have loved ones who are addicts. And I kind of learned this somewhat through that program is, you know, some people it's just about community. Maybe that's something greater than yourself is just simply community. Or maybe it's a principle like love, or maybe it's connection with nature. It doesn't have to be the, you know, fairies and goblins to qualify as spirituality. And the other reason why I personally am comfortable using the word spirituality is because the root word in Latin means breath. Mm-hmm. I'm a yoga instructor, and I've also studied Tai Chi. And at the end of the day, it's the breathing, and it's returning to the breath that helps us return to the present, which gets us through the shit. So, you know, that's it. I'm like, who can argue with the fact that we all breathe? And it is quite literally the source of life. So for me, I'm comfortable with the word spirituality, but just like, you know, the word religion and love and any of these words, they can mean different things to different people.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's so good that you have kind of spent this time thinking through exactly what you mean by that term. You're not just throwing out this term, oh, it's spiritual. You're actually saying, let me define by this, you know, what I mean by this word. And it sounds like for you, you're saying that spiritual doesn't necessarily equate with anything supernatural. It's just something that might be outside of or greater than your personal physical body. Is that right?
Physical body and my own thoughts or my own feelings. It's a yielding to something greater. And I don't exactly know what that is. And no, it doesn't have to be supernatural per se. I do want to mention, I'm not reading all the comments, but I am seeing a little bit about the value or the use of labels. And so I want to qualify, when I say love is greater than labels, I'm not saying labels are bad, because labels serve a function. Just like when we go to the store and we want to buy, you know, dog food versus canned chili, you want to make sure you know the difference. So labels can be very functional, but what I'm saying is love is greater than that. It's not that labels are necessarily bad. You know, that's how we categorize life and navigate life, is understanding what things are and how we go through it. But anyway, this notion that here's one of the more influential books that I read years ago was The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. And he starts the book by telling a story of a time in his life where he was severely depressed. And that depression had been lasting a very long time. And he said to himself, I can't stand myself, or I hate myself, or something like that. And then the epiphany hit him, where he said to himself, who is the I that can't stand myself?
Ooh.
So there was a higher awareness somewhere that what was going on in the myself part that he couldn't stand, that there was an awareness that something was greater than what this garbage, the noise. Mm-hmm. And that really hit home to me. I actually wrote a poem very similar to that when I was in high school. And that's where I'm getting at. And I really wish if we don't blow up the planet beforehand, I really would love to know, like in 1,000 years, 2,000 years, you know, what humans have learned about what we're trying to understand when we talk about these concepts.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like that's kind of been the focus of your journey then, is sort of unpacking that for yourself and what you think about that separately from what you were maybe indoctrinated into.
Oh, for sure. Definitely. It's been unpacking some luggage that was weighing me down for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And then once you're free of that, in fact, another analogy that I really like that I heard in Al-Anon years ago was, you know, when you growing up, you know, out in the rocky seas, let's say you're out just in the rocky ocean and the waves are just beating you around and you're just trying to swim to stay alive. And so you start putting on all these things to help you survive, and like the floaties and the flippers and the goggles and the mouthpiece and the inner tube. And, you know, and you acquire all of these basically survival mechanisms to try to help you survive whatever scenario you're in, where you're being mistreated or abused or whatever. And then eventually you land on shore as you get older, but you're still carrying all this stuff, and it's hard to walk and it's hard to function and it's hard to live freely because you have all these old survival mechanisms that you've acquired. And then you have to learn how to take it all off, you know, and get rid of it and realize it doesn't serve a purpose anymore. But then you're just standing there naked going, well, now what? And now how do I live and what do I do? And now you're faced with a whole new vista of challenges in life. And so my pursuit, you know, for the first 40 years of my life was probably, you know, unpacking all the what are those little arm things called?
the water wings.
All those things that we used to wear when we were babies.
Yeah.
Taking all that stuff off and now going, you know, but life's still kind of, Tupac was right. Life is pain. You know, I mean that there is some truth to that. And so now how do I cope with that when I don't believe that there's a fairy god floating in the sky, that if I'm good enough, he's going to, you know, sprinkle some fairy dust and make things better. And if I don't believe that anymore, now how do I navigate the pain of life?
Yeah.
That's where the secular spirituality really came into play for me.
Okay. Yeah. I really like that analogy. Actually, like you're carrying around baggage, but it wasn't just, you know, baggage. It's things that, you know, you developed to protect yourself and that were tools that were working for you under those circumstances.
Right.
But now they're not needed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really like that.
Rachel, do you want to talk about the poll results?
Yes, let's do that.
All right, let's share the results. Hopefully this works if I click share results. Can everyone see that now? Should be up on the screen.
Mm-hmm, I see it.
Perfect, okay.
Okay, so the first question, does the word spiritual, the majority who answered A, B, or C said, gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The majority said none of the above.
Well, yeah, I said of the people who took A, B, or C, the majority, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. Then still resonates was a little bit less than that, and make you want to punch something was about half of that. But none of the above was significant in that it was actually larger than they give you the heebie-jeebies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's interesting. And then the question, do you think it's possibly spiritual but not religious? The overwhelming majority said yes, 57%. Only 10% said no, and significance, 33% said I'm not sure. And then do you consider yourself to be spiritual? The minority said yes, 16%, no was 44, and I'm not sure was almost 40.
Ooh.
So I find that first part really interesting, give you the heebie-jeebies. And I have to say, when you're a host or co-host, you can vote in the poll, but I would have voted for that one too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's fair because, you know, now you've got, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow selling vulva candles.
Oh my God.
Under the guise of some spiritual something, and she's making a buttload of money off of it. And so, you know, that's a totally fair, a fair response. And that's why that was one of the responses that I had suggested. Come here, Tito. All right, here's Tito.
Yay! Cameo appearance. Yes.
Here's Tito. There he is.
We're going to put the link to your book up now while he's up there. Did you know that helps with marketing pretty much?
Oh, really?
Yes, I wrote a dissertation related to this. Hold on, let me get your link.
God. That's fine. But
yes, promote him. Help him promote you.
But the interesting thing about these results that I'm picking up on is that there's a significant amount of people who are still kind of in this space of like, I'm not really sure. Like, what does it mean? Well, you know, I mean, that's what I see in that is that there's a good amount of people because even though, you know, we're recovering from religion, I think it's fair to say that there is a deep intrinsic pull that many people feel towards something greater. Even if it's, I'm going to go stand on, you know, a mountain peak and look around and feel that awe of connection. Or, you know, what it feels like. It's like when I teach a yoga class and, you know, we've got a packed studio with 30 people or whatever, and we're all moving together and breathing together, and it's powerful. I mean, there's an energy there that is different than if it was just me by myself or even me with two other people. So I think there's this intrinsic pull that people feel And now we as a species are really trying to figure it out. Like, well, what does this mean? Because now we've realized there's not a dude floating in the sky. And and so what does it mean to have this pull? You know, I don't know.
I get what you're saying. It's almost like, you know, you're describing, you know, this experience that people may have previously labeled as, oh, this is God, or oh, this is magic. And you're saying, well, it's not that, but I'm still having this experience. So that's something to explore and unpack. Is that basically it?
Yes, pretty much. And I think too, and that's one of the reasons, like when my book is the almost the antithesis of St. Augustine's Confessions, in the sense that he wrote his confessions of leaving a pagan lifestyle to becoming a Christian. And I'm kind of leaving Christianity to, you know, become secular. And in doing so, I, you know, outline many of the reasons why. But what I realized when I was writing this book was that I really think for the first time in the course of human history, we are being faced with grappling with some of these age-old philosophical and/or spiritual issues. And we're having to reframe them and rethink, like, what is this part of the human condition and what does it mean? Because the information age has changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you made a great point a minute ago about talking about how even just this term spirituality is so kind of vague that it's been applied to these, you know, like, and maybe not, it's on MLM, but like, you know, the Gwyneth Paltrow eggs and things like that. It's almost like you can just throw this buzzword out and attach it to, you know, here's my vagina candle. Now you need this. Yeah. You know, it might or might not explode in your house. We don't know.
It's definitely a selling point for snake oil salesmen, because they know that people are coming out of mainstream religions. And a lot of them, as you're talking about, still have some sense of spirituality, to use that word. And then they just use that word and, hey, you know, buy my product. Mm-hmm.
You know, I will say that I have been trying to think of another term to use. And I sometimes, what I do is, I believe it's called code switching. I, depending on who I'm talking to, I'll use the language that I think they'll understand best. And so, meaningful living is a phrase that I've used when I talk with people who are, you know, very firmly atheist, and they just don't want any kind of language that remotely sounds spiritual or whatever. So we'll just talk about meaningful living, because at the end of the day, it's the same. But personally like the term spirituality, like I said, because it's about returning to the breath and the source of life. But then sometimes if I'm talking to an older adult who their worldview is what it is, and I'll even use the word God just to connect with that person, knowing that I may mean something different, and not to be disingenuous, because I don't mean it that way, but I personally value human connection greater than I value trying to tell somebody else that the way I define things or see things is the way. And so as long as my intentions are pure, I find that using different words sometimes just helps me connect meaningfully to other people. And then that's what's more important to me than the actual word itself.
Understand.
Yeah. That's interesting. And I like that you mentioned that you're kind of trying to communicate with people in a way that they're going to connect with, rather than trying to insist on using your term, or, you know, this is the way I'm defining that, to the point that you derail the conversation.
Well, and that's part of our challenge. And I write about this a little bit in my book as well, is that we're limited by language. Mm-hmm. We're limited. I mean, it's, on one hand, it's what allows us greater intimacy with one another, but on the other hand, it can be quite limiting. Mm-hmm. And particularly with these words that have become so charged, you know, and I would love to know if anybody out in the audience has some other suggestions, you know, because I tried to live a life without a sense of spirituality. And what I found was I stayed on the hamster wheel of my own mind. And so I found that this yielding, getting off the hamster wheel and yielding, letting go of the things you can't control, accepting that you can control, and the wisdom to know the difference, right? And so
I'm getting some Kramer serenity now kind of vibes here.
Yeah. So, but I would love to, I was looking to see if anybody had some other suggestions of terms to use. I really am interested to hear that. But I also had wanted to spend at least a few minutes, because I think we're coming up at the end of the close of the hour. I'm pretty sure.
You've got time. Take your time.
Okay. I wanted to give some examples of how what secular spirituality looks like in a practical way.
Ooh, and yes.
So is that okay if we pivot to that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts on that. Please do.
Okay. So I'd say there are three different buckets that I want to touch on in terms of practical secular spirituality. One would be daily practice. Two would be interior practice. And three would be the life arc practice.
Okay, that sounds fascinating. Please unpack all of those.
Okay, so daily practice, for example, my kids and I have on our table, we have a big glass jar that we call it the blessing jar. And we have a little stack of paper and a cup of pens. And before we eat a meal, we write a gratitude on that piece of paper, fold it up, put it in the jar. And then our tradition is every New Year's Eve, we dump out the jar and we read the year's worth of gratitudes. And then we start a new jar for the next year. And that replaced prayer.
For example.
And so it was a way to teach my children, you know, awareness of gratitude and some kind of habit, ritual, practice to be mindful, you know, of gratitude without, you know, dear God, thank you for this food. Amen. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah. You know, especially someplace where, like, if you're not living in a condition of like food scarcity, I mean, that almost kind of loses its significance. Like, thank you for this
100%. Food. Like, thank you for this food that Uber just delivered that.
Right.
But that's become a very, very meaningful thing for us. And then the other thing for me on a daily type of, dear God, thank you for the Uber. Yeah. another example of daily practice would be, I read a book years ago about feng shui and another practice called wabi-sabi. Mm-hmm. And feng shui has a lot of kind of new agey funny things in it that I don't do, but there was some merit to it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then with wabi-sabi, it's the whole idea of if you have something like a bowl, for example, and it gets chipped, as long as it's still functional, you find beauty in the bowl in its flaws. And so I have objects in my whole approach to the way that I have objects in my home is deeply spiritual for me. And so I have a big bowl that's chipped and that's part of the story and we love it. It's our big massive bowl we put popcorn in, for example.
Yes.
That's deeply meaningful. I got a record player and so my kids and I are really into vinyl and that's become deeply meaningful because it's a slower process and a careful process to listen to the music. And so it takes thoughtfulness to carefully take the record out and place it, you know, clean it, place it and lift the arm and lower it, you know, and all that. And it just, it slows us down and it causes us to have greater appreciation for the fact that this music that we're hearing didn't just magically appear, because digital music, as awesome as it is, and I do still listen to digital music, mm-hmm. it's like this whole consumer society, just faster, more, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And invented, by the way, because Data on the Next Generation walked into his quarters and said, computer, play, and he listed three songs. I don't know if you knew that. Yeah, so there's a young person who became an engineer and he said, oh my God, we should try to make that happen. And they did.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, Star Trek was like foreshadowed many things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm waiting for the replicator and it's coming. You know, you got the 3D yes. 3D printers now.
A little harder than digital music.
Yeah, we're getting there. We're going to get it.
And then transporting. I mean, then we are on to something.
Yeah.
We get
no, I'm with Dr. McCoy there. I'm not scattering my atoms all over space. Yeah. No,
I am too, because you're technically, you die.
You die. You're dead. It's a copy of you on the other entity, end.
And you don't know yeah. if it's, I mean, yeah. oh, would yeah. you still have not, your same consciousness? I mean, we would have happening. To answer all these questions. Okay. Sorry. Going back to Wabi Sabi.
Yeah. So anyway, those are just examples of just daily. And my whole home is full of, there's every object in my home either serves a function or is deeply meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. And if it's just meaningless crap, I get rid of it. And then the whole idea is that we don't keep acquiring it. But anyway, yeah. So that's daily. And then the other would be, I'm going to save the interior bucket for last. The other one was the life arc bucket that I was referring to in terms of secular spirituality. And what I mean by that is dealing with issues like, I'll just use myself as an example. You know, I turned 50 this year and
I don't believe you.
I do. No, I've got lots of light around me. It helped. But anyway, but you know, it's true that, you know, when you start hitting that middle age thing, you start like evaluating things and asking questions and, you know, and so, you know, that whole, those deep existential questions we ask ourselves as humans require some kind of, for me, some kind of spiritual understanding. So like for me, I've come to peace with the fact that I will become one with the earth and I'm okay with that. Like, I don't need to think I'm going to live forever, for example. And then, so when I start questioning, you know, my life and have I contributed enough to the world and all these things that we can get really wrapped up in, particularly when you're going through that midlife reevaluation phase, I have to have some kind of spiritual context for me about my story. My little bitty life on this planet is just meant to simply advance the game a little bit in whatever way that I can. And one of the things I learned through Buddhism was, you know, the whole idea of impermanence and that transitoriness and things keep moving. And then that's spiritual. So when I understand my life in that way, that I'm part of a flow that just keeps on going, then I tend to be more gracious with myself rather than being so hard on myself. Mm. And, you know, cause like many people, I think that's a tendency that we have to be super critical of ourselves.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I get the feeling you might've had a similar background as I did, but like, I remember being in, you know, a very, you know, strict religious community, you know, both of these things you've brought up so far would be kind of, you know, antithetical to what we would be learning in terms of like, well, you're born broken and imperfect, and that's yeah. terrible. And your job is to make yourself more perfect like Jesus, which you will never be able to do, but yeah. you know, you feel really bad about that anyway. That's really stressful.
Yeah, the section on my book on original sin was like two sentences long. It said, here's original sin in a nutshell. I love you, you suck. You know, I mean, yeah. it's like, I mean, you know, done. I don't have anything else to say about that. I mean, it's just, anyway.
Yeah, it's abusive.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
You're a piece of shit, but I created you because I love you. I mean, it just makes no sense. Anyway. Yeah. But that's the life arc. I mean, I could give other examples, but mm-hmm. just some of this more global picture issues that we deal with as humans. And then the bucket I was referring to regarding the interior self and the interior practice. I'll just give an example, because one of the things I really like to do is to be as transparent as possible. And if anyone were to actually read my book, you'll find that I'm pretty darn transparent. Because I wish people could be more transparent with one another. But I've recently had a loss in my life, a loss of a relationship, and I had the need to forgive. And the only thing that got me through that and pushed me through into a space where I could forgive this person was what I consider to be a spiritual practice. And that was a retraining of my mind and returning to my breath, so that when I felt an angry thought or a thought of self-pity or whatever, that I would take that energy and the energy of the thought in my mind, I would acknowledge it. And this is very much influenced by what I learned in Buddhism. I would acknowledge the thought like it's floating down a river. And I would inhale, physically, literally inhale with that thought. And then on that exhale, I would release the thought in love. And like maybe with the mantra of, I forgive. Mm-hmm. And then if thought came again, I'd go through the same process, the breathing and acknowledging, not trying to fight what's real. You got to acknowledge what's real, accept what's real so that you can convert that energy into something positive. And I spent a 3-day weekend alone with the sole purpose going into that weekend. I was full of anger and depression and some self-pity. And then I said, I'm going to forgive this person. And I spent that weekend going through this process of acknowledging all these feelings and thoughts and connecting it with my breathing. And then a mantra that would help me convert that into a relief. And it worked. I kid you not. And see, to me, that's spiritual. That wasn't something I could think through. That was something I had to connect with my breath and work through and yield it, let go of what, you know, I couldn't control. And that's very spiritual to me and not a thinking thing.
Oh, that's interesting. So, oh, okay. So also kind of a piece of spirituality then I'm understanding for you is kind of getting out of your own head and not just relying on your own conscious thoughts, but you're connecting exactly. with your body and your breath.
Yes. The I that knows
yeah.
the me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That Eckhart Tolle was referring to, mm-hmm. which in some religions, that third eye, you know, so like in when we say namaste, the light in me honors the light in you, where we touch this here, meaning that higher awareness.
Okay. Yeah. And I know this is kind of like Dr. Ray mentioned earlier in the chat, this does sound, you know, very similar to what you might encounter in like a mindfulness practice or something like that. I guess it sounds like you've got a little bit more going on in there too, but I know like recently I got one of those apps on my phone that's for like, you know, mindfulness and meditation. And there was a lot of what you were describing of kind of this, like, notice the thought and acknowledge it. We're not trying to suppress the thought, but, you know, recognizing that it's there and then just kind of moving on anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten into any of those apps. But I'm curious if there's any, I'd be curious to do a poll. I don't know if you can create a poll right now, but I'd be really curious to know if anybody uses any of those types of apps and if they're helpful. They must be, I guess, because they keep making them and selling them. But
yeah, sound off in the chat if you use any kind of app like that and let us know.
Because the reason I'm curious is, I guess it's just a new technology. It's no different than reading a book or whatever, but the work itself is all interior. Mm-hmm. And the app is, you know, just, I guess, an extension or, yeah. I don't know.
Well, and it may be one of those things that's just kind of like a tool that we've been using, you know, during the pandemic or something.
Oh no, because I'm an old lady now. And I'm Gen X, and we don't, you know, we're not doing all those newfangled things.
Oh.
Maybe that's it.
I don't know. I might be with you on that one. I can't even do the social medias. So.
But somebody just mentioned Dan Harris's Happier 10% Happier app. Are you familiar with that one?
Oh no, I have not heard of that.
Has great guided meditation courses.
Oh, interesting. Well, see, okay, well, here's the funny thing, guys. So I'm here tonight talking about secular spirituality, and I cannot stand meditating. I hate meditating, or at least in the traditional way.
Oh, and, tell us about that. Like, why? Yeah,
because it's boring.
I'm with you there.
Boring, and it's and then there's like all the, like, you know that meme, you know, of like the weightlifter dudes, like, do you even lift, man? You know, it's kind of like, do you even meditate? You know, it's almost become this, mm-hmm. like this way to gauge whether or not somebody's like spiritual or something. And I can't stand meditating, but what I have, or not in the traditional way where you sit and you like halfway close your eyes and you do this and, you know, like, I mean, ugh. But I have found moving meditating works for me. So that's why I love Tai Chi, for example. And I don't have much time these days in my life to practice Tai Chi. So what I do is I practice Tai Chi-ish while I'm, you know, folding laundry, or, you know, just very like, it becomes kind of like a present, something that I do that just keeps me present and that I'm mindful and grateful for the clothes, you know, or, you know what I mean? And so I have found that converting or everyday like normal activities into something that's meditative, that mm-hmm. works for me.
Okay.
But traditional meditation, washing dishes. That's exactly, I almost use that example too, because that's an example of when I talk about meditation is washing dishes, because it's a very cleansing thing. Like you're literally cleaning something and watching it come new again and just going through that process.
So you mentioned Tai Chi. I have to ask you this question. Is that what Worf does?
Worf? I don't know. I don't think he does Tai Chi. But
it's definitely something like that. I read reports that they took some of it and they changed some of it.
Oh, so you mean, was that in real life? Was that the inspiration for whatever
it
is?
Yeah.
I just remember the mating dance thing. That's what I remember.
That's something else.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So anyway, I hope to next, one of the next books I want to write is about the practice of secular spirituality. I'm sure there are many other books already out there, but that's something that really interests me. And that's something that I'm starting to pursue on my personal Instagram page, which is nothing, you know, fancy or whatever. That's something that I'm wanting to really kind of start to explore on my personal Instagram page.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that as we're kind of wrapping up, like, you know, what are you, kind of doing? What do you see in your future, for this? What are you working on? What kind of, suggestions do you have, for us going forward?
Oh man. No, I need to be learning from you. That's the truth there. It is my hope, as I am continuing to, I have three children and I have two more I need to get through high school, but I hope to write some more books and all that. But in the meantime, I am hoping to continue to connect with people, particularly on Instagram, just to start to have some just conversation about living meaningfully without religion. And for me, I call that spirituality, but I don't care what word people want to use, but just meaningful living without religion. But I must say, and I'm sorry, because I didn't say this earlier, but I want to say, and I think it's important for me to say this anytime I've done an interview, is that I am not anti-religion. I am anti-abuse of religion. Mm-hmm. And like I said, at the beginning of this program, I know many religious people who are the most loving, gracious, inclusive humans. Now I know many more that aren't.
Yes.
But you know what I mean? So, but for me, I think that there's this connection, you know, I've kind of, John Pavelitz, he's awesome. I've done the whole deconstruction thing, and I've worked through my anger at, you know, religion and the abuse and I'm done with that. Doesn't mean that I don't sometimes have feelings or thoughts that I still have to kind of tinker with, but I'm more about, what do we do now? Mm-hmm. How do we live now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, because I think you're right. A lot of times, you know, we go through that phase, the angry atheist phase, you know, yeah. And it's almost like you're still having those same kind of thoughts, like you were talking about. You're still carrying all the same mental baggage with you, and you're thinking in the same kinds of ways. But what's next? What about after Judgment?
Somebody just asked me about the book, I saw it in the chat, so I just thought I would show the camera.
Confessions of
an American Nun.
Excellent. I'm going to put the link in the chat as well. And can you tell us a little bit about that term nun? Like, obviously it's kind of a play on words, like nun, like a religious figure, but did you come up with that term, or like, what does that mean?
No, not at all. I learned the term in the 2015 Pew report, Changing Religious Landscape. I'm writing my Instagram handle in the chat as well.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. And I'll drop your other, do you want me to drop your other links in there too? Your email?
If you want to. Yes. Okay. Yeah, for sure. My email. I love to hear from people. I like to talk to anybody that wants to talk. I just think it's awesome.
All right. I'm going to drop those in there now.
I'm sorry, what was the question you had just asked?
You were talking about where the word nun came from.
Oh, right. Yeah. So in that report, the term nun has been used to describe people who select none of the above as their religious affiliation. That's actually been in use for over 20 years. It was first used by a demographer or a sociologist in England, I believe. And then, you know, but the only people that really paid attention to the term were mostly either demographers and sociologists, or the rabid evangelicals who, like, we got to go convert them, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. But when I read it in that report in 2015, I was like, wow, it's like the anti-label, and I loved it. And it also is indicative of what's going on just generally in our culture. People are not wanting to label their sexuality or their gender or, you know, their race, or, you know, they're like, just, can I just be me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, it seems to be real consistent just with, in general, what's happening in our culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm really excited. I have not read the book yet, but it is definitely at the top of my list. So I'm excited to read that. And it sounds like maybe there's a new one on the horizon too.
I hope so. Yes, there will be. There will be. Yeah.
Excellent. Be. Okay. I'm super excited. And you know, people always ask this, so I'm going to go ahead and ask, is your book available on audiobooks at all?
It is not, although I did start reading it on my Instagram page. So I have had done videos, and ooh, I need to pick it back up, but so you can Yeah, I was reading it and just have videos on my Instagram page.
So we can get a little preview on there then.
Yeah.
Excellent.
So I was perusing your site before, and I do have a question. So there was an item which said three features nuns have in common regarding their spirituality. Do you want to talk about that? So one was religion is a tool, but not necessary. Second one was truth is truth, no matter where you find it. And the third was yield to something greater than yourself. So you've talked about some of that, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what's the question?
Yeah, I don't know that if you meant the religion is a tool part. I'm not quite sure what that meant. Religion is a tool, but not necessary.
Okay, yes. So what I mean by that is that most nuns don't have a problem with other people being religious, even if they aren't. And so they just look at it like, hey, listen, if that works for you, if that's a tool, if that's a mechanism in your life that brings meaning or joy or community or whatever, and it works for you, great. So it can be something that just, like, for example, my own sense of like how I understand forgiveness has been greatly influenced by what I've read what Jesus taught. My understanding of how to tame the monkey mind is from studying Buddhism. So religion in that regard was a very useful tool for me. And doesn't mean I have to live a religious life or believe in the supernatural things that, you know, they may make claims to.
So take the things out of it that help you without going to the supernatural.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I do not agree with the idea that religion should be eradicated from the earth. I think it just needs to be redefined, and the goals need to be, because I actually put together a change.org petition called A Call for the Responsible Use of Religion Beyond Slaughtered Goats and Throwing Babies in Volcanoes, because humans have been doing crazy things in the name of religion forever. But we just have to change the marker, move the marker, you know, what's acceptable. It's no longer acceptable to slaughter goats in the name of your religion. And so it should no longer be acceptable to defy, let's say, for example, you know, what we now know in science in the name of religion. But having meaningful rituals and community and all that can be great.
So what do you think about the other problems with it, though? Like as exemplified by, you know, the anti-abortion law in Texas and the Supreme Court's ruling on that sort of thing.
Oh, you mean in terms of like how religion is being used to
change the laws? Yeah.
People's, yeah. Oh, it's bullshit. And that's why as a society, we have to say, no, that's not acceptable. And, you know, if you guys want to go create a colony somewhere where you can go live your weird little lives, that's fine. But I mean, you know, not in this world. So, no, it's not okay.
Mm.
But so that's the thing. Religion is a tool. It's just like an economic institution. Science is a tool. Science can be used for good or evil. We have the atomic bomb because of science. So, you know, things can be used for good or evil. It's the intention behind it. It's the application behind it that matters. And that's, you know, we also have, you know, our healthcare system started because of religious institutions. Our educational system started because of religious institutions. You have to remember that things are not always all good or all bad, you know? And so it's looking at the nuance and so forth. I'm not justifying any abuse ever. I'm just saying that it's a tool. I say in my book, religion is like a baseball bat. You can use it to bludgeon somebody to death, or you can hit a home run. And I know some religious people who are, like I said, very loving people. I personally just wasn't going to say I believed in stuff I didn't believe in anymore. And waste my time going to church on Sundays.
That's fair. So we actually have a practical question here. And I was wondering too, when I saw the title of the book, None with a Greater Than symbol and the O, and someone else says, what does that mean?
That what? I'm sorry.
So none, you write with the greater than symbol in the O, right? So what's the significance of that?
Yes. So the significance of that is, the slogan is love is greater. And then the symbol in none, the circle refers to the oneness of humanity, and or even just the oneness of the world, because we're interrelated with everything. And then the greater than is that love is greater than anything and is what unifies the one. It's the best thing. Now it's the best, the ideal principle that unifies and connects everything.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, since we're kind of in the question and answer session now, we've got a lot of questions. Let me mention again, if anybody has any more questions, now is the time. Type them in the chat. But yeah, we have quite a few questions here. Something else that some people were wondering about was when you talked at the beginning about, you know, kind of growing up in this, you know, kind of traumatic religious past, what helped you get out of that to the other side where you are now, where you seem a lot, you know, you seem very like comfortable and like, you know, you've really worked through these things. Like, how did you get here?
a lot of student debt. I mean, truthfully, that is one of the reasons why I, you know, studied philosophy of religion in undergraduate and then got the master's degree in theology, was just to try to make sense of some things. But it was, that's the great irony of all of this for me has been, you know, I had to learn to forgive. I had to learn how to find my sense of self-worth and to know to the deepest core of my being that I am loved, not because a particular human loves me, but because I am love. Mm-hmm. I participate in love just like we all do or can. And so that was the, you know, key to my survival, because it for me it was spiritual, and I'm looking, I think Jeff is asking, yeah, I am love, and he's saying, what does that mean? And that's a great question, because this kind of language sounds it sounds very just floaty, you know. I think to many people, it sounds very floaty and not very substantive. But when I say that I am love, what I'm talking about is that when you have that awareness of the interconnection of all things, then you realize that the source of life that animates me is part of the source of life of all of us and all of life. And it becomes a power greater than myself. And to me, I think I know I said this at the first interview with you guys, because we went into a very, very long conversation about corn. Do y'all remember that?
Yeah, okay. That might have been my fault.
Oh no, don't start up again.
So we're having puns now? Is that what I'm hearing?
We went into a long conversation about corn, but what I said was, see, now they're going crazy. What I said was that love is like porn. And the reason I said love is like porn, not corn, is because of that Supreme Court justice who was trying to define porn back in, I believe it was the 1970s. And he said, I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it, about porn. And that's the analogy I like to use about love. We know it when we feel it, when we experience it. And it's very difficult to put into words. And I'm not talking about just, you know, romantic love at all. Mm-hmm. So I know everybody would rather talk about corn.
I know. Now we got the chat going now. We are stuck on Corn Hub at this point in the chat. you've kind of come back to that point several times, kind of this idea that, you know, this is an embodied feeling for you. It's not something that you just think yourself to, but it's kind of like an experience that you feel in your body. Is that kind of what you mean?
What are you referring to, being spiritual?
Yes. And like your experience of love, you know, kind of, you were saying it's not something that you could define in words, but it's something that, you know, through the experience of feeling it. Is that, am I on track?
I suppose that's fair, but sometimes I don't feel it, you know? Oh,
well, yeah, I have, you know, that experience, I mean, sometimes too.
It's not just a feeling. It's because I don't believe, you know, that was the other thing, is that when I was religious, I had this belief that, you know, if I'm really a good religious person or a good spiritual person, then I'll always be like floating on a cloud, you know, because you transcend, you know, anger, or you transcend.
You know, I have the joy of the Lord, so yeah. I can never be depressed, you know.
Yeah, and I'm like, hell no. I go through all the things, you know, that any human does. The only difference is that I know that I don't have to be a slave to them. Mm-hmm. And that my feelings, just like those thoughts, my feelings pass down the river too. Mm-hmm. Feelings come and go. Mm-hmm. And participating in love to me is knowing that even when I am feeling downtrodden or feeling heavy or whatever, that I can return to my breathing and find different habits that help, you know, recenter and return to that place of centeredness and groundedness.
Okay.
So possibly connected to that, someone asked a question in the chat. What do you do about triggers that bring the terrible thoughts back? I guess the point would be, does meditation help? That sort of thing.
Well, I think, yes, I do still have triggers. And like, I have different triggers. Like the word spirituality is not a trigger to me, but if somebody asks me if I've been saved, I want to like stab them in the eyeballs, you know. That's my like feeling. I don't do it, but you know, it's just like the feeling that comes up inside of me. And so I have to manage those triggers, you know, just like we have to manage any trigger. And for me, it's again breathing. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to breathe, and that calms that. And you know, studies have shown it calms your heart rate. It slows your breath. It slows your breathing cycle. It'll calm the mind, you know, that whole thing. So when I get triggered like that, that's the first thing I do. And then the other thing that I do is, you know, I keep a few really close people in my life that if I need to just go vent for a moment, that I feel safe with, and I do that. And then if I'm in any way creating a scenario where I've invited a presence in my life that is frequently triggering me, then I will evaluate my role in that and making sure I'm not somehow inadvertently contributing to something that is destructive for me.
That's great. So it's kind of it's an ongoing process or practice then, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was trying to read some of the, don't worry. I have not stabbed anybody.
Yet. It's okay. we could have made that one of the answer choices in the poll.
but you know, to be fair, you actually didn't rule out all the other ways, like strangling somebody or.
Yeah. I mean, there are other options. This is going to be played back someday, and yeah, hope, just don't cancel me.
Yeah, that's okay. We do editing before we post these. You're good. No, no one was stabbed in the process of making this episode okay. of the show that we know of. I don't know where Eric is now. Hopefully he's okay.
Are there any questions from the audience or are we just reading through? I haven't been able to keep up with all the comments.
Actually the questions we've been asking are somewhat from the audience. So let's go back to the one from that term you threw out at the very beginning, hermeneutics, which got a lot of puns written. Somebody wanted to know, is historical contextualizing part of hermeneutics?
Yes. When it comes to the Bible. When it comes to the Bible, the hermeneutics is about the interpretation of the Bible. And there's just there are many different ways to approach the Bible. So.
Well, and, you know, I've got a follow-up question on that. You know, I kind of liked the way you mentioned earlier this idea of thinking about, you know, the social justice warrior version of Jesus and thinking, okay, given the conditions and the restraints that he would have been operating under at that time, if this is an accurate accounting, you know, he might have been behaving in a way that is a little different than, you know, what he might have said or done if he was living today. And that's one way of contextualizing. But I've also heard people kind of using context when they say things like, oh, well, you're criticizing, you know, these, you know, horrendous acts that are recommended in the Old Testament, but you just don't understand in the context of the time, you know, that would have been fine. And therefore, you know, it's still fine now. Do you make a distinction between, you know, those kinds of contextualizing or what do you think about that?
I mean, the way I describe the Bible, at least in part in my book, is it's just a beautiful mess. You know, there's some beautiful parts about it and there's some really messy parts about it. And the whole thing's a mess, really. And so, you know, it's very similar to some of the questions we're asking ourselves, you know, about, you know, the founding fathers of our country, you know, were they 100% assholes or, you know, was there any merit to that? You know what I mean? Because of some of the things that they did. And so those questions are just complicated questions with complicated answers, in my opinion. And that's why today, you know, the burgeoning faction of our country who is now saying, no, thank you to religion, we collectively need to decide what's acceptable and what's not. Today and moving forward. And so we can pick the Bible apart if we want to, but at the end of the day, frankly, if we're wasting our time doing that, then we're not dealing with some more important things that are going on in the present. I kind of avoided your question in a way because I don't think there's a simple answer. And people's approach to the Bible is like porn too. If it stinks, you know it. if they're trying to use it in any way to manipulate you or oppress you or strong arm you, then that's the problem. Mm. And that's what I say, no mas.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So once it crosses over into the place where it's causing harm, then we're not.
Of course, they know the problem is they don't think they're causing harm because they think they're trying to save you from, you know, eternal damnation. But yeah, you know.
Yeah. Fair enough. Okay. Well, we've got another question from the chat that I think sounds really interesting. I wonder if you could comment on. Someone was asking if you see a difference between this concept of spirituality as you define it and an aesthetic sense, such as an appreciation of beautiful landscapes or art. Would that be similar to spirituality or is there a distinction you would make? What would that be?
Yeah, and I did kind of touch on that earlier when I was talking about awe, you know, standing and looking at a vista or something like that. I think those practices or experiences can definitely qualify as a sense of spirituality without question. Because it taps us into something that is, again, just so much bigger than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think looking at all art does that, but
certainly, I mean, if it's not on Pornhub.
But no, totally. Yeah, I definitely think that can be an extension or a form of spirituality, for sure. And I think that's why, you know, some people, like, who are, let's say, serious athletes, like endurance cyclists, for example, you know, that may be their church, so to speak. That may be where they get that sense of just, I get in my zone and I get out there and I have the, you know, nature around me, and it's just freeing to them in a way that church, you know, claims to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think it's probably a good spot to end on too. Do you have any other, like, final parting words you want to leave us with before we go on to the wrap up and the hangout?
I mean, the only thing that I ever like to preach is this right here. And that, you know, it's all about the love. And yeah, so.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that. This has been wonderful. I always love when you come on the show, and I was looking forward to it, and you did not disappoint. I'm really excited to hear about your next book, whenever that comes out as well. So we're definitely so glad to have you sharing your thoughts and wisdom with us. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I was glad to be here too. I did my best to keep Eric out of the picture, so I was able to be here with you.
Yes. Yeah. Rob was like, get out of here. I want to be in this.
Thank you. I really appreciate the invitation.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.